today, because I want to introduce various quantities which you are going to need for next three lectures, which Neil will explain in far more detail. Okay, but if something is not clear, you stop me. We will come back to most of these things again on when I continue next week. Okay, so some things will not be in full detail, and we'll come back to them. So yesterday we saw how to write, how to relate. If you are given a manifold with some coordinates on it, and if I write a metric tensor on it, and if you change, if you make a coordinate transformation or a gauge transformation, which is infinitesimal coordinate transformation, then how do we relate the metric fluctuations in your case to the metric fluctuations in my case, and how we can construct some of the gauge invariant variables. Now we are going to start with similar thing for matter, which is much easier than the case of gravity. You can do it in full generality starting from T mu nu. I will not follow that path. Weinberg's book, for example, does that. I'll do it in a much simpler way. And the idea is that we know that we had two background, we have a background energy density, rho bar, and a background pressure, P bar. And these are scalar quantities, energy density and pressure. So we will just look at the how scalars transform. And you can show that under the transformation which we had, that x goes to x mu plus an infinitesimal transformation epsilon mu as a function of x and tau. You can show easily that if you have a scalar q, then delta q bar is just delta q minus q alpha epsilon alpha. This you can do, for example, in an exercise in the tutorial today. It's very similar to the tensor properties. So using this, so this is some scalar q which is given to us. And using this, now it is very easy for us to compute what is the perturbation. So if I write, if I have delta rho tilde, and if I want, how does the matter perturbation change? How does the perturbation energy density change? Delta rho minus delta rho tilde minus delta rho, then it will be, sorry, this is bar. The background energy density, rho bar prime alpha, epsilon alpha. Okay? We know that our background energy density only depends on time. It doesn't depend on, we are not having any gradients, spatial gradients of it. So this is just minus rho bar 0, epsilon 0 for us. And from here, you can easily show that if I write, if in the Bardeen notation, this is epsilon tilde, and this is epsilon, then epsilon tilde is epsilon plus, this is E dot, in Bardeen's notation, E dot, E0 dot T, because epsilon 0 was our T. And then we can use a conservation law to get 3H E naught plus P naught T. So it's very simple how to get the gauge transformation. How does under this coordinate transformation the fluctuation in the matter density changes. Okay? So we can similarly do pressure. So this was energy density. Let us do pressure. So the pressure will be delta of P tilde minus delta of P, which in Bardeen's notation will be pi tilde, small pi tilde and small pi. We'll introduce a capital pi next week, because this is not our standard notation which we use in most of the books. So this is a small pi. And then this will be just minus P bar alpha epsilon alpha. And this will be just minus P 0 dot T in Bardeen's notation. Again, because pressure only depends on time, it doesn't have any derivatives, non-zero derivatives in space. This is our perfect fluid in the background, right? There was another quantity which we had written. If you recall,
the if you look at the there are two more quantities which we have written actually. So let us write them carefully.
So we took the matter perturbations as follows. We had energy densities perturbation epsilon. We had a momentum density di psi, which was a first order perturbation itself. This is a small psi. It's not Bardeen potential. This notation is can be now very confusing because we are introducing similar symbols. It's P naught plus pi delta ij. This was our background. Plus we introduced the anisotropic stress. As a perturbation. This is equation 35 A to C in Bardeen's review. Okay? This is what we did earlier. So this was our energy density perturbation. We have computed it. We have computed how does pi change. Now let's compute how does sigma change. Okay? And it is very easy to see that sigma will not change at all. Because it's already a first order perturbation, so if I do the same logic here, I will get sigma tilde minus sigma equal to minus sigma bar alpha epsilon alpha, but there is no sigma bar in the background, so it is zero. Okay? So since sigma itself is a first order perturbation at the linear order, essentially like there is no sigma bar in the background, so this is, so the anisotropic stress is zero, which is very nice because if it was not zero, if this quantity was not zero, then it means that by just doing a coordinate transformation, you can go outside the perfect fluid model which you started with. Okay? So that means in the both, as I stated yesterday, we are assuming that we have the same background, essentially in different coordinates, that's all. So if I start with a perfect fluid model in the background, you also have a perfect fluid model in the background, which means that this had to be zero because this is an isotropic stress. This tells us about the deviations from the perfect fluid. Okay? So now your homework, because most students have already done the homework, which I gave for this week. So your homework is to show that, where is that? Yeah. Your homework is to show that sigma tilde, so we have shown for all these, we haven't shown for this, Ji. This is the homework. So you have to show that sigma tilde with n not equal to 1 transforms like this. This can be slightly tricky to show. Okay? The hint is you start with, don't start with sigma, or you can also start with sigma. You have to use the definition of P mu nu here. All this we did without using transformation properties of P mu nu. For this you will need to do. At least this is the way I have tried it and I have done it. But you may do it separately than that. And you have to use the properties of T mu nu and essentially use the fact that it is rho P u mu u nu plus P g mu nu. And then recall what was T0i. T0i is 0 in the background. Okay? But sigma came because of the perturbation delta T0i if n naught is 1 is di psi. This is the way we introduce this perturbation in the momentum density. Okay, we have done that earlier. So what you'll have to do is you'll have to look at the transformation properties of T0i, delta T0i. Okay? Find them. Is essentially what you'll have to do is instead of starting with the scalar now, you'll have to take into account how does the velocities transform, ui, how do the vectors transform. Then you'll be able to find delta T0i, and from there you'll be able, that will come in form of a di something, and then you'll have to forget about the gradient, and you will get this, psi tilde is psi plus. What you'll have to do essentially is that you'll have to find delta of T0i bar minus delta of T0i from here. And that will give you what is delta of psi. It's straightforward with this hint. You'll have to find what is UI. How does use transform? Essentially, okay. So this I'm giving as a homework exercise. If you're not able to do, we will do it in the class next week. Okay, so let us write down the. So this is a homework exercise, okay. So this will complete our analysis of how different variables which we have introduced so far, they transform. So let us write them. Let us write the results now on this side. So does somebody have any more questions on how to do this? Then I will give more hints. Or you can ask next week. The basic idea is that to find this, at least this is the way I have done. Maybe you can do it differently. To do this, you have to look at the transformation properties of team union. Not the scalars are not sufficient because psi comes through a vector gi. Okay, so trying with scalar is not going to help. So we have to work with the transformation properties of the vector. What we have to do as a special case is forget about full team union, look at just T0i component, see how it transforms. That will involve how use transform, how the velocity vector transforms. And once you get that, then it is just three in three lines you will get this answer. Once you get this answer, how this transforms, it will be clear how delta psi transforms because T0i by definition is this. Delta T0i, okay? Okay, so now let us go ahead. So let me write all the results here. So you see, out of all the quantities, out of all the quantities which we wrote here as the matter perturbations, it is only the anisotropic stress so far, which is gauge invariant. It is fully gauge invariant. Okay, and that is a consistency check on that we are doing these gauge transformations properly. So let me write the results and then we go forward. So we have epsilon tilde as epsilon plus 3H in Bardeen's notation. So when Neil gives lectures tomorrow, he will stick to Bardeen's notation. So you don't have to worry that he will change the notation. We have agreed on that. So pi tilde is pi minus P0 dot T. Sigma tilde is sigma. And psi tilde is psi plus E0 plus P0 T. And let us write also the matter part, because gravity part, because we are going to need it now. What is it? Okay. So for the gravity perturbations, we have phi tilde as phi minus ht, gamma tilde as gamma minus lambda. We have beta tilde as beta minus t by a square plus lambda dot. We have chi tilde as chi minus t, phi gamma beta chi, alpha is left. Kappa tilde is kappa plus delta t plus 3h dot t. What about alpha? So what is alphas? I somehow have missed one page. Alpha tilde is alpha minus t dot. And we also introduced the two potentials. Phi h is phi minus h chi, and phi a is alpha minus chi dot. So this is a full set of the gravity and matter perturbations which we have derived. Okay, so now let us go ahead and write down and let us try to construct some gauge invariant variables for matter. So I want to construct a gauge invariant variable for energy density perturbation. Okay, so now it is very easy to see that if I'm just given So this is a matter line here. Above it is matter and below it is gravity. So if I just want to play with the matter part without touching the gravity perturbations, so first of all I can write down mixed quantities easily, because anyway gravity perturbations and matter perturbations are going to mix in the dynamics. So I can always construct gauge invariant variables apart from these two, which were fully gravity based, which are mixed in these two, okay, using them to cancel the coordinate transformations. So, but let us first do the one which is fully matter. So let us construct gauge invariant. Okay, so first one is a quantity epsilon m, which is defined as epsilon minus 3 h psi. This is just from the matter part, and it is very easy to see that this is gauge invariant, because epsilon m tilde is epsilon m minus 3 h psi tilde, and you can use the first and the fourth equation to see that this is just epsilon m. Okay, because epsilon tilde is epsilon plus 3h e naught p naught t, and if I multiply psi tilde by minus 3h, then the second term in psi tilde cancels the second term in epsilon tilde. Okay, so this is one of the quantities, and I will come back to it in a moment again. But you see, the interesting thing about this quantity is that if you choose a gauge psi equal to 0, if your foliation is such that on the hypersurfaces you have psi equal to 0, then your epsilon is actually you can think of epsilon as a gauge invariant quantity, because epsilon m just becomes equal to epsilon. Okay, and this we will see in few moments, that this is our co-moving gauge. This is a gauge in which the matter, in which the fluid can be thought of as at rest. You are flowing with the fluid all the time. You are in the matter frame. We will do this in few moments. So this is the co-moving gauge. I'm just introducing it before I should, but I just want to comment that this gauge invariant variable is just equal to epsilon if you do the co-moving gauge. Similarly, we can construct another quantity for energy density. Let us call it epsilon g. We are calling it m and g just because of historical reasons. Like people who introduce, they call it m and g. That's why. And this is a mixed quantity. It is defined through matter and gravity perturbation. So if I do epsilon, then epsilon is epsilon plus 3h e naught plus p naught t. And if I take this term, epsilon g tilde will be this plus 3h e naught plus p naught chi. And then you will get a minus 3h because chi transforms under the temporal gauge transformations, and this goes, and epsilon g tilde is epsilon g. Okay? So similar to here, that epsilon m was equal to the perturbation in energy density in the co-moving gauge, which we will introduce in few moments, that is when psi is equal to 0. Epsilon g is equal to epsilon in the zero shear gauge, which we introduced yesterday, in the Newtonian gauge. Okay? So you can write down different gauge invariant variables, and each of them have a different meaning in different gauges. That's a very important point, and this is what Bardeen stressed all the time in his review. So you can write down various gauge invariant variables, but most of the times they lack meaning in different gauges. So just to emphasize again, so this quantity, this quantity, so epsilon g is equal to epsilon in chi equal to 0 gauge. That is Newtonian gauge. Or the zero shear gauge. They are all same things. Okay? So epsilon g is equal to epsilon zero shear gauge, but epsilon g is not equal to epsilon in co-moving gauge. Similarly, epsilon m is the perturbation energy density only in the co-moving gauge, not in any other gauge. So every gauge invariant variable has a particular meaning in a gauge. In most gauges, it may not have any meaning at all. Okay, so now I want to give another exercise, but I don't know whether I should do it in the class now, or it depends on you, whether you want another exercise for homework. So let me see. So similar to epsilon and epsilon g, you can write down quantities for psi, something like psi epsilon and psi g, which will have different meanings in different gauges. So do you want to try to do that, to construct? I will not give you the answer. I'm giving you the inverse problem. To find the gauge invariant combination of psi, one using just the matter part, and one using one input from the gravity, in particular the chi part, such that one of them is equal to psi in the zero shear gauge and another in the gauge where the fluctuation in energy density are zero. Do you want to see that explicitly, or do you want to do that yourself? Sorry? You want to try? It's very similar to this. The answer is already here. One of them will be exactly same. You just have to change the symbol. Okay, so let me give you the exercise then. Some of you find it interesting. So this is the second homework problem. Both of the homework problems are doable within 15 minutes each, if you start from the right step. Okay? Or even 5 minutes. For some of you. So what you have to do is construct a gauge invariant version of psi such that this quantity, let us call it psi g, such that psi g is equal to psi in zero shear gauge. That's the first part. Then construct another gauge invariant version of psi such that, let us call it psi m, is equal to psi when the fluctuations in the energy density are zero, which is called the uniform density gauge. So this finishes the homework for this week, both of these exercises. Okay? So any questions so far? Then we will go ahead with another topic. Is it clear what we are doing with different perturbations? Okay, so I am introducing now new kind of thing. We are still on the matter perturbations.
But there's something which I don't know whether you guys have been told.
Have you been told about entropy perturbations? No? Okay. So this is, we may need it, but we are introducing it because entropy perturbation is gauge invariant object. Okay? So let us do it. So there are two kinds of, when you go through the perturbation theory, there is, many times people discuss about adiabatic perturbations, and if the perturbation is not adiabatic, essentially there is an entropy component there. So let us go back a little bit in our fall class. So we know that equation of state, if you are given pressure and energy density, then equation of state is given by W here, okay? And if you are given a fluid made up of some pressure and energy density, then it is adiabatic. So it is the propagation is adiabatic, and the adiabatic speed of propagation, CS square, or which is also called the sound speed, or the propagation of the speed of propagation of the perturbations is given by CS square equal to delta P by delta rho, which is essentially P dot by rho dot. Okay? This is the definition of the speed of propagation of the perturbation if it is adiabatic. Okay? For the adiabatic perturbations. More generally, if you don't have adiabaticity, for example, if you have more than one fluid, then these interactions between two fluids can lead to departures from adiabaticity. Then, more generally, we have an entropy perturbation, which is defined. So more generally, we have departures from adiabaticity measured by entropy perturbations. So this is true only if perturbation is adiabatic. CS square is delta P by delta rho only if the perturbation is adiabatic. This is the definition of adiabaticity. Think like that. Okay. So if there are departures from adiabaticity, then they are measured by entropy perturbations. And the entropy perturbation is defined as, it's a definition of the entropy perturbation, that gamma, it is called gamma, this entropy perturbation, gamma is defined through this equation as 1 over omega rho delta P minus CS square delta rho. This is the definition of entropy perturbation. Okay? So if the perturbation is adiabatic, then entropy perturbation is zero, because then this bracket is zero. Okay? If this bracket is not zero, if this is not satisfied, that is, adiabaticity is not satisfied, then this bracket will be non-zero, and the entropy perturbation will be non-zero. That is the idea. Okay? So this can be written as, so I can bring omega rho is just pressure by this relation, P equal to omega rho. So this can be written as, this is many times written in the books as P gamma is delta P gamma is delta P minus CS square delta rho. This is also used as the definition of the entropy perturbation. Okay? It's a very simple concept. So most of the perturbations, most of the life which we have dealt with in cosmology so far is with this adiabaticity. This is the definition of adiabaticity, that adiabatic fluid satisfies that the speed of propagation of the perturbations or of the sound is delta P by delta rho from thermodynamics. If there are departures from this relation, they are captured by entropic perturbations like this. It's a very simple idea. Okay. So now let us show that this gamma is gauge invariant. It is very easy to show because this is anyway the background. We don't care about it. We just have to see what is delta P minus CS square delta rho. how does it behave?
So let us derive that. Okay, so where is gamma?
So let me write down gamma in that second big box in Bardeen's notation. I don't think Bardeen introduces entropic perturbations in his review, but we are certainly going to need it for our next week. Otherwise, we'll be lost.
Maybe he introduces somewhere in some line, but I haven't seen any expression for it.
So in Bardeen's notation, gamma, so we have P gamma, by definition, is delta P minus Cs square delta of rho. So in Bardeen's notation, this just tells us that gamma is 1 over P naught, which is a background P. This is background. This rho and this P are background quantities, not the full inhomogeneous quantities. So this is pi minus Cs square epsilon.
Okay. So we can now show that this is gauge invariant.
And for that, let us compute first pi tilde. We have computed pi tilde, but I want to do it in a different way now. So we know the answer. Pi tilde is pi minus p dot by t, p dot 0 by t. But we know what is Cs square. So Cs square is just p0 dot by e0 dot in Bardeen's notation. Okay? So I can write down p0 dot t as pi minus Cs square e0 dot t. And then I can use the conservation law, and I can write down this as 3Cs square h e0 plus p0 t. Okay? I started with this, which we have derived. Then I just used the speed of sound in this relation to replace p0 dot. I got an e0 dot. I use the conservation law. I get this. Okay? So now we are almost there, because we will write gamma tilde as 1 over p0, which will be pi tilde minus Cs square epsilon tilde. And this will be 1 over p0. Pi tilde will be pi plus 3s square h e0 plus p0 t. And then epsilon will be minus Cs square epsilon minus 3Cs square h e0 plus p0 t. So this cancels with this, and we get gamma tilde equal to gamma. So the entropic perturbations, or the perturbations which measure departures from adiabaticity, they are gauge invariant objects, which is a very nice property of entropic perturbations, because they play a very important role in a realistic scenario. Because in a realistic scenario, we have many fluids interacting with each other, and in that case, entropic perturbations will in general be non-zero. Okay, so let us write this here, that we introduce gamma, and gamma tilde is gamma. Yeah?
How did you find Cs squared to be adiabatic when n still have a gamma? You said Cs squared is p naught dot over e naught dot.
Well, that's actually a good question. Let me see.
Because this is the background, we are looking at the perturbation. The entropic perturbation is over the background. The background is perfect fluid, so it has no entropic perturbation.
So this is the background.
Yeah, background is perfect fluid, and the perfect fluid satisfies. Thanks for asking this. I didn't think about this earlier. Good point. So in the background, this is true, but not in general, in the full inhomogeneous situation. Okay, so now let us go to different gauges. Now let me introduce the different gauges. We will come back to it again next week. But I just want to give you some of, I just want to advertise you some gauges which you will learn about more tomorrow. Because tomorrow what Neil is going to cover is the matter perturbations, the equations which we didn't derive in the beginning. But since doing in full generality is quite lengthy, he's going to take one gauge and do it fully. One thing which I think you pointed out very well yesterday after the class, which I forgot to point out, is that suppose you are given some set of equations and you fix a gauge, let us say, the Newtonian gauge or synchronous gauge and so on. And then we were yesterday, as you were also saying, that we can identify phi h with some phi, and then we can, if I just work with zero shear gauge, I know my phi is phi h, okay, till the end. You can for convenience, you can fix a gauge, and if in the end you can write down your equations which you obtain in a fully gauge invariant way, in the sense of gauge invariant variables, then your answer is going to be unambiguous of the chosen gauge. That should be your task. If you take a gauge, write down the final answer in terms of gauge invariant variables. If you do that, you're clean. Then somebody else can do more generally, somebody else can do a different gauge, he will get the same answer. Okay? But you have to identify in the end all your variables with the gauge invariant variables. That is a very important point. So that is what Neil is going to do tomorrow when he does matter perturbations. And I think when he does the matter equations in GR hydrodynamics, and then he does matter perturbations, I think he's going to work with one of the gauge, but he will then write the answers in a gauge invariant way, and then you can be happy that, well, I could have done in a more general way as we did for the full gravity case, and everything is fine. Okay? So most of the calculations which are done in most research papers, most books, are done in exactly this way. People take a gauge, and then people in the end, their task is to write in a gauge invariant way. Gauge invariant variables. Once you do that, then the predictions are going to be fine. But as we have also seen, just choosing a gauge invariant variable doesn't mean anything. There is a particular meaning attached to it only in a particular gauge. It's not that if I write phi h equal to phi in zero shear gauge, I can say what the Bardeen potential is equal to the intrinsic curvature perturbation only in that gauge. It's not that in synchronous gauge it has the same meaning, right? Because it was obtained, this expression was obtained putting chi equal to 0. Chi is not equal to 0 in the synchronous gauge. So that is something which we have to remember, which many times is not true when we look at the literature. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce some more gauges. I'm going to tell you about some gauges. It's not fully exhaustive list. And then we will do this in detail next week. So this will tell us more about some things which we have been listening in last two lectures. So one very popular gauge is the synchronous gauge. And synchronous gauge corresponds to, it's essentially, I'm writing the main statements. We can do more detailed things. It's very interesting because every point in the space-time corresponds to a free-falling observer. And this gauge is set. Okay, so we had, let us write the metric perturbations. So we have perturbation in lapse, alpha, perturbation in shift, beta, and then we had perturbations in hij, which were captured by phi and psi. Okay? These were our full set of metric perturbations. And synchronous gauge corresponds to alpha equal to 0, beta equal to 0. That's the definition of the synchronous gauge. That there is no perturbation in lapse. The lapse is fixed. You can fix it to 1. then you just have lapse as the proper time. The lapse is not perturbed. The shift vector is not perturbed. And that is why this gauge is very nice, because in this gauge, you can put G00 equal to minus 1, full G00, not the perturbation, not the background, full. It is full. It's not G bar. The full, the slicing is done in such a way that there is no perturbation in lapse at all. It is just like you are just flowing in the Newtonian way through with the proper time or with the time. There is no perturbation in shift at all. This is full G0i. There's not background. Okay? And if you do that, essentially what we mean is that we foliated the manifold such that we foliated the manifold at t equal to constant, and with t equal to constant, and put spatial coordinates such that clocks are synchronized on the manifold. So geometrically, this is the meaning of synchronous gauge, that if I have foliated it in a way that I have no perturbation in lapse, I have no perturbation in shift, I have a hypersurface, and when I put coordinates on this hypersurface, then if I have a clock and you have a clock somewhere else, we know that if the shift vector was non-zero, the clocks will not be synchronized. But now your clocks and my clocks, they are all synchronized. So we all flow with the same time, all the time. This is why this gauge is very nice, and it's used many times in codes and so on. The biggest problem with this gauge, one of the biggest physical challenges with this gauge, is though it is very nice that all points correspond to freely falling observers, they all, if the gravitational field is non-uniform, that is, it is converging somewhere, then all these points go and hit a singularity. Because it's just like you are, like all the points will freely fall. There is no way the gravitational effect is going to be canceled. And if the gravitational field is uniform, that would have been fine. But if the gravitational field is non-uniform, then there are singularities as a problem in this gauge. So that is why, though this gauge is very nice, it has never used in real time, in real life applications of numerical relativity. Cosmologists use it a lot, but a numerical relativist will never touch this gauge, because he knows that he is going to hit many times in just coordinate singularities in this gauge. Okay, so they just avoid it. They use it only for testing purpose. Another problem with this gauge is that it is not completely fixed. There is a residual freedom in this gauge. So there are two residual freedoms in this gauge. And essentially, if you think about it physically, it essentially means how you set your clocks initially, or how you give your spatial coordinates initially, and how you fix your time coordinate. But let us see why there are two freedoms. Residual freedom. This is the main problem. This is what Bardeen criticizes in his paper a lot. And this was the earliest gauge which was introduced in cosmology. So now let us see why there is a residual freedom. So let us go back. We know that alpha and beta are set equal to zero if I go into synchronous gauge. So let us look at alpha and beta. So alpha tilde is alpha minus t dot. And beta tilde is beta minus t by a square plus lambda dot. And now let us go to the synchronous gauge. Alpha tilde equal to 0, beta tilde equal to 0. So we have gone to synchronous gauge. This is in general, the coordinate transformation occurs. But now we will go to synchronous gauge, that is, this, our tilde We started with some some coordinate map, and this x tilde and tau tilde, which we introduced, this x tilde mu vector, let us say it corresponds to a gauge choice, which is a synchronous gauge, in which alpha tilde is 0 and beta tilde is 0. So if alpha tilde is 0, then it implies that t dot is alpha, and beta tilde is 0, it implies that lambda dot is beta, lambda dot is t by a square minus beta. Okay. Now let us, so our task is now to find what is t and lambda. So we integrate these two equations, and we'll find that t is some integral alpha dt, which is some metric perturbation integral over time, the lapse, plus some constant, arbitrary constant C1. And similarly, lambda will be some minus beta dt plus an integral t by a square dt, plus a second constant C2. So there are two arbitrary constants, C1 and C2, in the synchronous gauge, which are not fixed by anything. They're completely arbitrary. Okay, these are our residual degrees of freedom. We need to fix them somehow. And we don't know how to fix them, because if in some gauge it happens that lambda, suppose you would have got that t is equal to alpha, then you would have been very happy, because then you know that this gauge transformation which you have taken just corresponds to a metric perturbation. So if I have done my theory consistently, I don't have to worry about any other degrees of freedom in the theory. But this didn't happen in this case. We in fact got t dot equal to alpha, we integrated it, and we found that something is still left. There is still an unknown in the theory which I don't know how to fix. Okay? So that is what these two correspond to, the residual freedoms in the synchronous gauge. Okay? Yes? What are the boundaries? So they will depend on your physical situation, what you are considering. In general, there is no limit. They can go from minus infinity to infinity in general.
If there's no limit, then there will be other integral constants from the integral.
Why?
Because it's no boundary terms, then you will need to add it.
So this C1 is an integration constant, which if you give me a boundary, then C1 will be determined, right? Because then it is a... But the point is that at the moment C1 is an arbitrary constant. So I don't know. So you have to give me more data. I think you are also saying the same thing to fix this residual degree of freedom.
Yeah, there will be an indefinite one, so it will go up to t. And then the other boundary doesn't matter because we have a constant anyway.
Okay, so let's go ahead. Okay, the other property of the synchronous gauge, which we may come back to next week. I wanted to do next week, but I thought it is important because there was a student who asked how to show this. So, another property is that in the synchronous gauge, the matter is not stationary. Okay, it will only happen if you take dust. And we can see it next week, how it happens. Let me introduce now some more gauges because we need them. Let us take co-moving gauge. So the co-moving gauge has a property. So it's a frame. Think of it as a frame in which matter is at rest.
So this has particularly two forms. What we are doing is a comoving time orthogonal gauge, in which the definition is that psi is 0 and beta is 0 in the comoving gauge. And this essentially requires that ui is 0. And in the Bardeen's notation, it requires ui equal to 0 and g0i equal to 0. And this requires that psi equal to 0 and beta equal to 0. Because if ui is 0, we know about t0i perturbation, right? And t0i was giving us psi. So that is why psi is 0, because t0i component is 0. And g0i gives us beta equal to 0. This is what is the definition of comoving gauge. Okay, so this is very nice because for simple matter systems, we can solve analytically all the equations. And one can also show that there is a problem in this gauge also. So this is the definition of this gauge for us. The problem is there is still a residual freedom. So if you want, we can do it. Otherwise, you can try it in the tutorial. So there is one residual freedom left, even if you do the comoving gauge. Okay, so there will be no arbitrary constant in T, but if you will do the integration, you will find there is an arbitrary constant left in lambda. Okay. Okay, so what are the properties here? So in this gauge, some more properties, that we have Ti0, the full Ti0, not the background. The full Ti0 is 0. And then there are observers which flow. There can exist observers which flow with the matter flow. And as I said earlier, in synchronous gauge, you even if it has very nice properties, it is not that matter is at rest. Okay? But in this, the fluid is at rest. This is by construction of this gauge. But you can have synchronous co-moving gauge, and that is only possible if you have dust. Okay, because dust is pressureless, so it will always follow the geodesics. If you have pressure non-zero, there can be deviations from geodesics, and then from the definitions of this and this, there will be no domain of intersection of these two gauges. So only if you have pressureless fluid, then it can be simultaneously synchronous. You can do it simultaneously in synchronous and co-moving gauge. So therefore, many people do dust perturbations jointly in the synchronous and co-moving gauge using both of their nice properties. So let us do now the third gauge, which we have seen earlier, which is very nice gauge to work with. Okay, maybe we should write somewhere what we are doing. We have a table here. So let's make different gauges. So we did synchronous gauge. In the synchronous gauge, alpha is 0, there is no shift, there is no perturbation in the lapse and shift. Alpha is 0, beta is 0. It is very nice gauge to physically visualize. There are only perturbations
one very important point which I didn't stress, only perturbations in Hij. Okay, only on the hypersurface. Nothing else. Like you can just do on the hypersurface and then you can be very happy with your gauge. The second what we did is co-moving gauge. So this is T0i, you can think of it as 0. In this, this is a nice property. You have psi equal to 0, you have beta equal to 0, fluid at rest. So every gauge has its nice properties. And every gauge has its drawbacks. Sometimes there are residual freedoms, sometimes some equations are too complicated to solve, and so on. Okay? So now let us do the Newtonian gauge, or the longitudinal gauge, or the zero shear gauge. We will see next week why it is called Newtonian gauge. So the property of this gauge is that expansion is isotropic. There is no shear in the world lines. Which is a very nice property again. Because then you don't have to worry about anisotropies, which can be very cumbersome sometimes. So in this gauge, chi is 0. There's no shear in the world lines. And then the expansion is isotropic. And then you can write down, so chi equal to 0 implies essentially for us that a square, we had a square by m naught, gamma dot plus beta, this is 0. And if gamma, since gamma and beta are independent metric perturbations, this essentially means that gamma dot is 0 and beta is 0, or gamma is 0 and beta is 0. Okay? A very nice property of this gauge is that there is no residual freedom. It is completely fixed. And this can be easily seen if you integrate these equations for beta and so on. So if you integrate beta equal to 0 equation, and if you use the gamma dot equal to 0 equation, you can find that lambda will be just gamma, and similarly T will be just chi. T will be just chi in this case. There is no constant which will appear. And lambda will be just gamma. Lambda dot will be gamma dot, and so on. So this gauge is completely fixed. There is nothing left in this gauge to be fixed. Okay, and it is actually ironic that in this gauge, phi h is phi, and sometimes people call that we work in the gauge in which the curvature perturbation is equal to the gauge invariant body in potential. But the fact is that this is the gauge which you have completely, in which there is no freedom left, so there is nothing left to be proved to show any invariance. Yeah. Because these are two independent metric perturbations, so this equation implies that they are separately zero. There is apparently no relation between them. They were two independent metric perturbations we started with. That's why. Otherwise, you can work with a constraint gamma dot plus beta is zero. But then it implies that they are dependent metric perturbations, right, which they are not. So we cannot have a constraint on gamma dot and beta dot. Otherwise, we will get into problems with our degrees of freedom, which we started with. You know, like we counted all these scalar degrees of freedom. There, these are independent degrees of freedom. And we already have imposed all our constraints and got these equations. So there are no further constraints on them, on these degrees of freedom. So now let us go to the one more gauge. Degree of freedom. Okay, so there is another gauge which I will just, two gauges which I will just mention. We are not going to do much details about them. So this is a gauge which is very popular in numerical relativity, uniform expansion gauge or maximal slicing gauge. It comes under different names. Most of the codes in numerical relativity are done in this gauge, not in cosmology. The reason for in this gauge, what we do is we set the capital K, which was our trace of the extrinsic curvature, to be 0. This is one choice you can take. And we also set that its derivative, delta T of K, is 0. In cosmological context, we know that K is not 0. So we require the foliation such that K is constant, and delta TK is also constant, or delta TK is 0. So what it translates to in cosmology, this gauge, is that you are not changing your Hubble parameter. You have a fixed expansion rate. You have done the foliation of spacetime such that your geodesics have a constant expansion rate, and its derivative is 0. If you do that, you make sure you will not hit a singularity. Okay? Because then these geodesics will not converge. They will have the fixed expansion rate. You will always have the same geometry for the geodesics. And this was essentially introduced to solve the coordinate singularity problem of the synchronous gauge. Because synchronous gauge corresponds to freely falling observers, this goes beyond that. This asks, like, instead of talking about freely falling observers, let us ask the expansion rate remains the same for the geodesics. And then we are not going to get into the problem of singularities. That is why this gauge is very popular in numerical relativity, because we always have to worry about a singularity in the black hole when they do the excision and so on. Okay? It's also called maximum slicing gauge. The last gauge which I'm going to introduce is we are not going to do more details of this. We don't need it. If we need it, we will do it. But I don't see we are going to need. Next week we are going to work with synchronous and Newtonian gauge. We'll also not do co-moving gauge in more detail. So the last is uniform density gauge. And uniform density gauge is obvious by definition what it should be. It just means epsilon is 0. You choose the foliation given the matter content such that there is no perturbation in the matter density. So it is all foliations have same density. There is no perturbation in that. And we have seen one example of that and where we chose, what did we choose? We had epsilon M or maybe epsilon G. We had something. We had epsilon. Oh, sorry. I gave you a problem to construct a psi m such that psi m is psi in this gauge, uniform density gauge. Okay? Okay, so I think, like, technically I should stop here, but I haven't finished what I wanted to finish. So if you can allow me 2 more minutes to introduce one more thing which you are going to need on Monday and Tuesday. Okay? So let us define zeta, which is our most popular symbol in cosmology literature. Which is also the curvature perturbation in constant energy hypersurfaces. So we want to construct a gauge invariant quantity. So we see that epsilon is not a gauge invariant quantity, right? If I look at the energy density fluctuation, it is not a gauge invariant object. Let us try to construct a gauge invariant object from epsilon once more, not the epsilon m or epsilon g. So we know that epsilon goes to epsilon plus 3h E naught plus P naught T with N naught equal to 1. So let us define a quantity zeta as phi plus epsilon by 3 E naught plus P naught. And now it is very easy to check that this zeta is gauge invariant, because zeta tilde is phi tilde plus epsilon tilde by 3 E naught plus P naught. And this phi tilde is what? Phi tilde is phi minus HT. And this is epsilon tilde. So let us use epsilon tilde from there. This is epsilon by 3 E naught plus P naught plus HT. Because E naught plus P naught in the denominator cancels with E naught plus P naught in the numerator, and 3 cancels with 3. So this HT cancels, and we get just zeta here. The very nice property of zeta, which Neil will prove you in the class, is zeta is conserved at large scales in our universe under some assumptions. This is a very important quantity in the perturbation theory. So he will prove you. If he doesn't prove, I will prove you, but he will prove. He has told me. So xi is conserved at large scales. What it means, like, we will come to know early next week. Another very nice property about zeta, and then I will stop, that zeta has two meanings. Okay? So the first meaning of zeta is that since zeta is phi plus epsilon by E naught plus P naught. Now you can have two choices of gauge. If we take epsilon equal to zero gauge, which is the uniform density gauge, then zeta is phi. That is, it is just intrinsic curvature perturbation. Number one. Number two, if we take gauge in which the intrinsic curvature is zero, right? We can always take that gauge in the slicing in which phi, there is no perturbation in the perturbation in phi part is zero. If we take phi equal to zero gauge, that is gauge in which intrinsic curvature perturbation is zero, then zeta is just epsilon by E naught P naught. So zeta is sum of phi, which is a measure of intrinsic curvature perturbation, and epsilon, which is a measure of metal curvature perturbation. It's a gauge invariant object. It has very beautiful properties. It is conserved at large scales, which will be proved to you. But the very nice property is that if I go to uniform density gauge, it is curvature perturbation. If I go to uniform curvature gauge, it is energy density perturbation. So it has a dual purpose. So that is why it is very nice. Okay? So we will talk about it more. Neil will talk about it more in full detail about this in his lectures. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop. We have done all the gauge transformations. We have seen all the gauges which we wanted to see. Now, from tomorrow, you will not be doing gravity perturbations. You will do the matter perturbations once more, some of the equations which we didn't do. And then, I think in his last lecture, Neil will prove this to you, that all the nice properties of zeta. He may introduce another curvature perturbation R, which is also very easy to see, like this. Okay? When I see you again next week, most probably on Wednesday, then we will write down the equations which we have written down, which Neil would have given you and which we derived in the class, in the fully gauge invariant way, so that we have the final set of equations which we always use in cosmology. And then we will go to Newtonian or synchronous gauge, and we will try our best to see some of the physical properties of the power spectrum for some cases. Okay, this will be our goal in the last three lectures of the class. Okay, any questions for gauge transformations or this what we have done today? But some, most of the things are clear, or some things are clear, or so only some things are clear. Okay. We didn't show the recurrent gauge is residue free, but you can do the, it's very similar to synchronous gauge calculation. Okay? It's just two light integrals which you have to see. Okay. Thank you.